You know that you look pretty good naked.
Pretty good?
That's right, fish for compliments, I said.
That's not all I'm fishing for, he whispered.
He picked me up by sliding his hands under my rear, and suddenly I was at just the right height to kiss him. So an evening that had held so much that was bad ended in something good after all, and for 15 minutes I utterly forgot that I was in the same bed he'd sat on while he took blood from someone else, which may have been the target Eric was aiming for. He hit it, dead center. He got downstairs in the nick of time. Chapter 5. I didn't roll out of bed until noon. I'd slept very heavily, and I'd had bad dreams. I woke up groggy, and I didn't feel refreshed at all. It didn't occur to me to check my cell phone until I heard it buzzing in my purse, but that wasn't until I'd drunk some coffee, showered, and put on the change of clothes I kept in the closet, and, no matter what Eric had said, gathered up all the dirty service items, as flight attendants call them. By the time I dropped my hairbrush, opened my purse, and groped inside to extricate the phone, my caller had hung up. Frustrating. I checked the number, and to my astonishment, I found that Mustafa Khan had been trying to get in touch with me. I called the number back as quickly as I could press the right buttons, but no one answered. Crap. Well, if he wasn't picking up, there wasn't anything I could do about it. But I had other messages, one from Dermot, one from Alcide, and one from Tara. Dermot's voice said,
Suki, where are you? You didn't come home last night. Everything okay?
Alcide Hervo said,
Suki, we need to talk. Call me when you can.
Tara said,
Suki, I think the babies are going to come pretty soon. I'm effacing and I'm starting to dilate. Get ready to become an aunt.
She sounded giddy with excitement. I called her back first, but she didn't pick up. Then I called Dermot, who actually answered. I gave him a condensed version of the night before. He asked me to come home immediately, but he didn't offer an explanation. I told him I'd start back within the hour unless the police arrived to delay me. What if they wanted to come into Eric's house? They couldn't just come in, right? They had to have a warrant. But the house was a crime scene. I was worried about them trying to get into Eric's downstairs bedroom, and I remembered that Bill was in the bedroom across the hall in a guest pod. What if the cops decided to open it? I needed a set of those Do Not Enter Vampire at Rest coffin hangers I'd seen advertised in Eric's copy of American Vampire. I'll be there as soon as I can, I told Dermot. I hung up, feeling a bit worried about Dermot's insistence that I return. What was happening at my house? With great reluctance, I returned Alcide's call. He'd only try to get in touch about something pretty important, since we weren't exactly buddies anymore. We weren't exactly enemies, either. But we could never seem to be happy with each other at the same time.
Suki, Alcide said in his deep voice, how you doing?
I'm okay. I don't know if you've heard what happened here at Eric's last night.
Yeah, I heard something about it.
No surprise there. Who needed the internet when you had the soups around? Then you know Mustafa's missing.
Too bad he's not Pack. We'd find him.
Pointed much? After all, he's a werewolf, I said briskly, and the police do want him. I know he could explain everything if he'd just come in and talk to them. So maybe if someone in the pack sees him somewhere, you could let me know? He called me, or at least someone using his phone did. I missed the call, and I'm really worried about him.
I'll let you know if I find out anything,
Alcide promised.
I need to talk to you about something else, though.
I waited to hear what he had in mind.
Suki, you still there?
Yes, I'm just waiting.
I'm hearing a complete lack of enthusiasm.
Well, considering last time. I didn't even need to finish the sentence. Finding Alcide naked in my bed had not endeared him to me. There was a lot to like about the werewolf, but his timing had never matched mine, and he'd taken some bad advice.
Okay, I was wrong there. We had a good result from you acting as our shaman, but I was wrong to ask you to do it. And I freely acknowledge that.
Alcide said that kind of proudly. Had he joined Werewolf Manipulators Anonymous? I looked at myself in the mirror and widened my eyes to let my reflection know what I thought about the conversation.
Good to hear that, I said. What's up?
Rueful chuckle.
Charming, rueful chuckle.
Well, you're right, Sookie. I do have a favor to ask you.
I showed myself amazed in the mirror.
Do tell, I said politely.
You know my pack enforcer has been going out with your boss for a while.
I know that. Cut to the chase.
Well, she wants you to help her out with something, and since you two have had your differences, for whatever reason, she asked me if I'd call you.
Sneaky Janilyn. This was like a double fake something.
It was true I liked Janilyn much less than I did Alcide. It was also true, though perhaps Alcide didn't know this, that Janilyn suspected my relationship with Sam was far more than it should be between an employee and her boss. If this were the 50s, she'd be checking Sam's collars for lipstick stains. Did people do that anymore? Why did women kiss collars anyway? Besides, Sam almost always wore t-shirts.
What does she want me to help her with? I asked, hoping my voice was suitably neutral.
She's gonna propose to Sam, and she wants you to help her set the stage.
I sat down on the end of the bed. I didn't want to make faces in the mirror anymore.
She wants me to help her ask Sam to marry her? I said slowly. I'd helped Andy Belfleur propose to Hallie, but I couldn't imagine Janilyn wanting me to hide an engagement ring in a basket of French fries.
She wants you to get Sam to drive down to Mimosa Lake, Alcide said. She's borrowed a cottage down there, and she wants to surprise Sam with a dinner, kind of romantic, you know? I guess she'd spring the question there.
Alcide sounded oddly unenthusiastic, or perhaps unconvinced that he should be relaying this request.
No, I said immediately. I won't do it. She'll have to get Sam there on her own.
I could just envision Sam imagining that I wanted him to go out to the lake with me, only to be confronted by Janilyn and whatever she thought of as a romantic dinner, live rabbits they could chase together, maybe. The whole scenario made me acutely uncomfortable. I could feel a flush of anger creeping up my neck.
Alcide said,
Sookie, that's not
helpful or obliging. I don't want to be, Alcide. There's just too much room for disaster in that plan. Plus, I don't think you understand Janilyn too well.
What I wanted to say was, I think she's trying to get me somewhere alone to kill me or to stage some scene to make me look guilty. But I didn't. There was a long silence.
I guess Janilyn was right, he said, letting his dismay into his voice. You do have it in for her. What, you don't think she's good enough for Sam?
No, as a matter of fact, I don't. Tell her I automatically started to say I was sorry I couldn't oblige her, and then I realized that would be a big fat lie. I'm just unable to be of assistance. She can do her own proposing. Goodbye, Alcide.
Without waiting to hear his response, I hung up. Had his enforcer wrapped Alcide around her little finger or what?
Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, shame on me, I said. I wasn't sure if I meant Alcide or Janilyn or both of them.
I fumed as I gathered my few things together. Help that bitch propose to Sam. When hell froze over, when pigs flew. Plus, as I told Alcide, if I'd been fool enough to go out to Mimosa Lake, she'd have staged some drama for sure. As I locked Eric's kitchen door behind me and stomped out to my car in my now painful high heels, I said words that had seldom crossed my lips before. I slammed my car door shut behind me, earning a sharp look from a sleek, well-groomed neighbor of Eric's who was weeding the flower bed around her mailbox. Next, people will be asking me to be a surrogate mom for their babies because it would be inconvenient for them to carry their own, I said, sneering in an unattractive way into my rearview mirror. That reminded me of Tara, and I tried her number again, but with no better result. I pulled in behind my house about 2 o'clock. Dermot's car was still there. When I saw home, it was like I gave myself permission to run into a wall of weariness. It felt good that my great uncle would be waiting for me. I grabbed my little bag of dirty clothes and my purse and trudged to the back door. Tossing the clothes bag on the top of the washer on the back porch, I put my hand on the knob of the kitchen door, registering as I did so that 2 people were waiting inside. Maybe Claude was back? Maybe all the problems in Fairy had been solved and everyone at Hooligans would be returning to the wonderful world of the Fae. How many problems would that leave me with? maybe only 3 or 4 big ones. I was feeling honestly optimistic when I pushed the door open and registered the identity of the 2 men seated at the table. Definitely an OSM. One man was Dermot, whom I'd expected. The other was Mustafa, whom I hadn't.
"Jeez Louise, where have you been?"
I thought I was going to yell, but it came out as a startled wheeze.
"Sookie,"
he said in his deep voice.
"We thought you were dead. We were scared sick about you. What happened?"
"Take a deep breath," Mustafa said. "Sit down and just take a breath. I got some things to tell you. I can't give you a full answer. It's not that I don't want to. It's really a life or a death."
His statement cut off the next 7 questions poised to pour off my tongue. Tossing my purse on the counter, I pulled out a chair, sat, and took a deep breath as he'd advised me. I gave him all my attention. For the first time, I absorbed his ragged appearance. Mustafa's grooming had always been meticulous. It was a shock to see him rumpled, his precise haircut uneven, his boots scuffed.
"Did you see who killed that girl?"
I asked. "I had to." He looked at me, looked hard. He didn't answer.
"Did you kill that girl?" I tried again.
"I did not."
"And because of this situation you referred to, you can't tell me who did?" Silence. I was sickeningly afraid that Mustafa was trying to tell me, without spelling it out, that Eric had killed her, had ducked out of the house after I'd shut myself in the bathroom. Eric could have lost his temper, projected his anger with himself onto Kim Rowe, and tried to make things right between him and me by snapping her neck. No matter how many times during the previous night I told myself such a premise was ridiculous, Eric had great control and was very intelligent. He was simply too aware of his neighbors and the police to do such a lawless thing, and such an act would simply be irrational. I'd never been able to tell myself that Eric wouldn't have killed her simply because doing so was wrong. This afternoon, all those bad thoughts I had entertained came crashing back as I stared at Mustafa. If Mustafa had not been aware, I would have sat on his chest until I read the answer in his brain. As it was, I could only get an impression of the turmoil in his head and his grim resolution that he would survive no matter what. And he was consumed with worry for someone else. A name crossed his mind. "Where's Warren, Mustafa?" I asked. I leaned forward, trying to get a clearer read. I even reached toward him, but he flinched back. Mustafa shook his head angrily.
"Don't even try, Sookie Stackhouse. That's one of the things I can't talk about. I didn't have to come here at all, but I think you're getting a raw deal, and you're caught up in the middle of stuff you don't know about."
Like that was a new situation for me. Dermot was looking back and forth between us. He couldn't decide how to act or what I wanted him to do. "Join the club, Dermot."
"You tell me what's going on, and then I'd know what to be careful of," I suggested.
"This was a mistake,"
he said, looking down and shaking his head.
"I'm going to find somewhere to hide while I look for Warren."
I thought of calling Eric, leaving a message telling him his day man was here. I'd keep Mustafa a prisoner until Eric could come fetch him, or I could phone the police and tell them a material witness to a murder was sitting in my kitchen. These plans passed through my head with great rapidity, and I considered each of them for a second. Then I thought, "Who am I kidding? I'm not going to do any of those things."
"You should go to Alcide," I said. "He'll keep you safe if you pledge to the pack."
"But I'd have to face..."
"Janelin, I know, but that'll be later. Alcide'll keep you safe for now. I can call him." I held up my little phone.
"You got his cell number?"
"I do."
"You call him, Sookie. You tell him I'm trying to meet with him. You give him my cell number, and you tell him to call me when he's by himself. And that's a big thing. He has to be by himself."
"Why can't you call him?"
"It'd be better if it came from you," he said, and that was all I could get him to say. "You got my cell number, right?"
"Sure."
"I'm leaving now."
"Tell me who killed that girl."
If I could have yanked the answer out of him with tweezers, I would have.
"You just be in more danger than you are now," he said,
and then he was out of the room and onto his bike, and then he was gone. This had all occurred with such speed that I felt as though the room were shivering after he left. Dermot and I stared at each other.
I have no idea why he was here instead of in Shreveport where he belongs. I could have held him, Dermot said. I was just waiting for a signal from you, great niece.
I appreciate that, great uncle. I guess I felt like that just wasn't the right thing to do, I muttered.
We sat there in silence for a moment, but I had to explain to Dermot about the night before.
You want to know why Mustafa showed up here? I asked, and he nodded, looking much more cheerful now that he was going to get some background. I launched into my narrative.
No one knew her, and she hadn't come with anyone?
He looked thoughtful.
That's what they all said.
Then someone sent her, someone who knew there would be a party at Eric's. Someone ensured she could walk in and not be challenged because there were strangers at the house. How did she get past the guard at the gate?
These were all pertinent questions, and I added another one.
How could anyone know in advance that Eric wouldn't be able to resist taking blood from her?
I sounded forlorn, and I could only hope I didn't come across as self-pitying. Unhappiness will do that to you.
Obviously, she was selected because she had two-natured blood of some variety, and then she enhanced that with the smell of fairy. We know too well it's enticing to the debtors. Since Mustafa's phone call made you late, and therefore Eric was more willing to yield to temptation, Dermot said, Mustafa must have had some hand in what happened.
Yeah, I figured that out.
I wasn't happy about this conclusion, but it fit the evidence.
He may not have known what would happen as a result, but he must have gotten instructions from someone to make you late.
But who? He's a lone wolf. He doesn't answer to Alcide.
Someone has power over him, Dermot said reasonably. Only someone with power over him could make a man like Mustafa betray Eric's trust. He's looking for his friend Warren. Would Warren have some reason to want Eric behind bars?
Dermot was really operating on fully charged batteries today. I was having a hard time flogging my tired brain into keeping up with him.
That's the key, of course, I said. His friend Warren. Warren himself would have no reason I can think of to want to harm Eric, who, after all, provides Mustafa's livelihood. But I think Warren's being used as a lever. Someone's taken Warren, I think. They're holding him to ensure they have Mustafa's cooperation.
I need to think about all this, I said, yawning with a jaw-cracking noise.
But right now, I just have to sleep some more. You going over to Hooligan's?
Later, he said.
I looked at him, thinking of all the questions he'd never answered about the strange accumulation of the Fae at a remote strip club in Louisiana. Claude had always told me it was because they'd all been left out when Niall closed the portals. But how had they known where to come, and what was their purpose in remaining in Monroe? Now was not the time to ask, since I was too exhausted to process his answers, if he would give me any.
Okay, then, I'm taking a nap, I said.
It was Sunday, and Merlot's was closed.
Just let the answering machine take the calls, if you don't mind.
I switched the ringer volume down even further on the kitchen phone, and would do the same in the bedroom. I took my cell phone into my bedroom and called Alcide. He didn't answer, but I left him a message. Then I plugged in my cell phone to charge. I dragged my weary body into my bedroom. I didn't even take off my clothes. I fell over the bed and fell asleep. I woke 2 hours later feeling like something a cat spit up. I rolled onto my side to look out the window. The light had changed. The air conditioner was fighting the afternoon's worst heat, which shimmered in the air outside. I sat up to look out the window at the dry grass. We needed rain. More random thoughts floated through my muzzy head. I wondered how Tara was doing. I didn't know what effaced meant. I wondered what had happened to Mr. Cataliades. He was my sponsor, apparently the otherworldly equivalent of a godparent. I'd last seen the mostly demon lawyer running through my yard, being chased by gray streaks from hell. Had Amelia gotten back from France yet? What were Claude and Niall up to in Fairy? What did it look like there? Maybe the trees looked like peacock feathers and everyone wore sequins. I checked my phone. I hadn't heard from Alcide. I called again, but it went right to voicemail. I left a message on Bill's cell to tell him that Mustafa had made an appearance. After all, he was the Area 5 investigator. Though I'd showered at Eric's that morning, that seemed like a week ago, so I got under the water again.
Then I pulled on old denim shorts and a white t-shirt and flip-flops and went out in the yard with my wet hair hanging down my back. I positioned the chaise perfectly to keep my body in the shadow of the house while my hair was trailing over the end in the light because I liked the way it smelled when I let it dry in the sun. Dermot's car was gone. The yard and house were empty. The only background noises were the ever-present sounds of nature going about its business, birds, bugs, and an occasional breeze fluttering the leaves in a lazy way. It was peaceful. I tried to think of mundane things, a possible date for Jason and Michelle's wedding, what I needed to do at Merlot's tomorrow, how low on propane my tank might be. Things I could actually solve with a phone call or a pad and pencil. Since my car was in my line of sight, I noticed that one of my tires looked a little soft. I should get Wardell at the tire place to check my pressure. It had been wonderful to shower without worrying about having enough hot water. That was the upside to Claude's absence. It was good to think about things that weren't supernatural. In fact, it was blissful. Chapter 6. When it was dark, my phone rang. Of course, that wasn't until after 8, this far into the summer. I'd had a very pleasant few hours all by myself. Pleasant didn't mean a positive good to me anymore. It meant an absence of bad. I had done a little straightening in the kitchen, read a little, turned on the television just to have voices in the background. Nice. Not exciting. I'd had enough exciting. I hadn't checked my email all day, and I'd considered giving it a pass for a couple more days. I found I didn't really want to answer the phone either, but I'd left messages for both Alcide and Bill. On the third ring, I yielded to habit and picked it up. Yes, I said.
Sookie, I'm on my way over to see you,
Eric said. See, I knew there'd been a good reason for not answering. No, I said. I don't think so. There was a little silence. Eric was as surprised as I was.
Is this a punishment for last night?
He asked. For drinking from another woman when I was present? No, I think I have that issue squared away.
Then what? You really don't want to see me?
Not tonight. I do want to say a couple of things to you, though.
By all means.
He sounded stiff and offended, which wasn't any surprise. He could deal with it. If Bill is still the Area 5 investigator...
He is?
Cautious. Then he needs to get to work, don't you think? He could take Heidi with him, since she's supposed to be such a great tracker. How did Kim Rowe get past the guard? Unless someone bribed the guard, and it was a guy I didn't know, it's possible Kim came up from the gate at the back of your yard, right? Maybe Bill and Heidi could discover how she got there. Plus, I need to talk to Bill about something.
That's a good idea.
He was thawing out, or at least he wasn't dwelling on the offense he'd taken. I'm full of them, I said, feeling anything but clever. Also, how did Felipe know all about the death of Victor?
None of my vampires would say a word,
Eric said with absolute certainty.
Colton is still in the area, but Emmanuel has gone to the West Coast. You would not tell anyone. Mustafa's friend Warren, who acted as our cleanup man.
None of them would speak. Warren wouldn't say boo to a goose if Mustafa didn't tell him to. I thought so, anyway. I didn't really know much about Warren, who wasn't big on talking. I was just about to tell Eric that Mustafa had appeared in my kitchen when he continued,
"We should have taken care of Colton and Emmanuel."
Did Eric mean the vampires should have killed the human survivors of that vicious brawl, even if they'd fought on Eric's side? Or was he simply implying he should have done a preemptive glamour, erasing their memories? I closed my eyes. I thought of my own humanity and vulnerability, though glamouring had never worked on me. Time to move on to another subject before I lost my temper. Do you know why Felipe is really here? 'Cause you know it's not because of Victor, or at least only partly because of Victor.
Don't discount his need to discipline me for Victor's death,
Eric said.
But you're right. He's got another agenda. I realized that last night.
Eric grew more guarded.
Or at least I became surer of it.
So you already know this secret agenda, and you're not telling me.
We'll talk about it later.
Of course, I should have told him about Mustafa's visit, but I lost my remaining patience.
Uh-huh, right.
I hung up. I looked down at my hand, a bit stunned at my own action. I spotted the little bundle of mail and the newspaper on the counter. Earlier in the day, I had walked down the driveway in the bright sunshine to retrieve the previous day's mail and the Daily Shreveport newspaper from their respective boxes on Hummingbird Road. Now, I sat down to read the paper. On the front page, I discovered that Kim Rowe had been 24, she had been from Minden, and, after looking at the picture of her accompanying the main article, I wasn't surprised to read she'd recently been fired from her job as an exotic dancer for assaulting a customer. That must have been a hell of a night at that strip club. The cause of Kim's death, according to the paper, had been a broken neck. Quick, quiet, requiring only strength and the element of surprise. That was why, even in that quiet neighborhood, no one had heard her scream. Not even Bill, with his vampire hearing. Or so he said. Kim Rowe, I discovered, had good reason to have a short temper. Rowe was desperate for money. She was behind on her car payments, and her landlord was about to evict her. Oscar Rowe, the victim's father, said she was doing crazy things to earn money. That was the short and sad story of the life of Kim Rowe. One thing stood out. She'd had nothing to lose. Of course, much was made of the fact that she'd been found on the lawn of a prominent vampire businessman and his party guests. Eric and his uninvited company were in for a hard time with the publicity machine. There was at least one picture of T-Rex in his wrestling costume. The words bulging and manic came to mind. I turned to the inside page, where the article continued. Kim's grieving parents were posed clutching a Bible and a bouquet of daisies, which they said had been Kim's favorite flower. Though I chided myself for my snobbishness, they didn't look like much. Before I could finish the article, the phone rang. I jumped about a foot. I'd been wondering if Eric would call back after he'd had enough time to get really angry with me, but the caller ID let me know my caller was Sam. Hey, I said.
What happened last night?
He asked.
I just watched the Shreveport news.
I went over to Eric's house because of the out-of-town vamp visitors, I said, condensing. This Kim Rowe left the house right after I got there. Eric had taken blood from her. I had to pause to collect myself. Then Bill found her dead on the lawn. They might have hushed it up. Oh, hell, of course they'd have hushed it up. Moved her body or something. But the police had gotten an anonymous call that there was a body at Eric's, so the police were there before he even knew her body was on the lawn.
Do you know who did it?
No, I said. If I knew who'd killed her, I'd have told the cops last night.
Even if the killer was Eric?
That stopped me dead. It would depend on the circumstances. Would you turn in Janilyn? There was a long silence.
It would depend on the circumstances, he said.
Sam, sometimes I think we're just dumb, I said, and then I heard myself. Wait, not speaking for you, just for me.
But I agree, he said. Janilyn, she's great, but I feel like I've bitten off more than I can chew some days.
Do you tell her everything, Sam? How much did other couples share? I needed some feedback. I'd had so few relationships. He hesitated.
No, he said finally. I don't. We haven't gotten to the I love you stage yet, but even if we had, no.
My mental focus took a U-turn. Wait a minute. According to Alcide, Janilyn had told him she was going to propose. Sure didn't sound like Sam was ready for that, if they hadn't even told each other they loved each other. That couldn't be right. Someone was lying or deluded. Then Sam said,
Sookie,
and I knew I'd been letting silence fill the air while I thought all this. So it's not just me and Eric, I said hastily. Between us, Sam, I feel like Eric's not telling me some pretty important stuff.
What about the things you aren't telling him? Are those things important?
Yeah, they are. Important, but not personal. I hadn't told Eric about Hunter, my little second cousin, being telepathic like me. I hadn't told Eric how worried I was about the concentration of the Fae in Monroe. I'd tried filling Eric in on the Fae situation, but it had been easy to tell that the politics of his own kind were at the top of his list these days. I couldn't blame him for that.
Sookie, you're okay, right? I don't know what you mean by not personal. Everything that happens to you is personal.
By personal stuff,
Things that are only about me and him. Like if I wasn't happy with the way he treated me, or if I thought he needed to be around more, or if he'd go with me to Jason and Michelle's wedding. If I needed to talk about any of those things, I would. But I know pieces of information that affect other people, and I don't always tell him those things because he has such a different perspective.
You know you can tell me if you need to talk about something. You know I'll listen and I won't tell anyone.
I know that, Sam. You're the best friend I've got. And I hope you know I'm always ready to listen to anything you need to talk about. I'm sure Eric and I will get back to normal when Felipe leaves, when the boat stops rocking.
Maybe you will, he said, but you know that if you get nervous out there, I got an extra bedroom here.
Janelin would kill me, I said. I'd spoken the first thought that went through my head, and I could have slapped myself. I'd spoken the truth, but I was talking about Sam's girlfriend. Sorry, Sam. I'm afraid Janelin believes you and I have a lurid past. I guess she's not there tonight?
She's working tonight at Hair of the Dog. She's watching the phones and the bar traffic while Alcide's having meetings in the back room. You're right, she's a little possessive, he admitted. It was kind of flattering at first, you know, but then I began to wonder if that means she doesn't have any faith in my integrity.
Sam, if she has a grain of sense, she can't possibly doubt you.
I was pretty sure Janelin blamed it all on me.
You're an honest guy.
Thanks,
he said gruffly.
Well, I've kept you talking long enough. Call me if you need me. By the way, as long as we're talking about relationship stuff, do you know why Kennedy's mad at Danny? She's been snapping at everyone.
Danny's keeping some kind of secret from her, and she's afraid it's about another woman.
It's not?
Sam knew all about my telepathic ability. No, it isn't. I don't know what it is. At least he isn't stripping at hooligans. One of us had talked, which was inevitable, and the story of JB's second job had gotten a lot of comment in bon ton.
She didn't think about just asking Danny what he was doing?
I don't think so.
Children, children, Sam said, as if he were in his 60s instead of in his 30s.
I laughed. I was in a better mood when we hung up. Dermot came in about half an hour later. Normally, my great-uncle was at least content in a low-keyed way. Tonight, he wasn't even approaching happiness. He was actively worried. What's up?
Claude's absence is making them restless.
Because he has such charisma that he keeps them all in line? Claude had as much personality as a turnip.
Yes, Dermot said simply. I know you don't feel Claude's charm, but when he's among his own people, they can see his strength and purpose.
We're talking about the guy who chose to stay among humans rather than go into fairy when it was closing. I just didn't get it.
Claude's told me two things about that,
Dermot said, going to the refrigerator and pouring a glass of milk.
He said he knew the portals were closing, but he felt he couldn't leave without tying up his business affairs here, and he never imagined that Niall would really stick to his decision. On the whole, the gamble of staying here appealed to him more, but he told the others, all the assortment of Fae at Hooligans, that Niall denied him entry.
I noticed that Dermot was admitting, though not explicitly, that he didn't have the high opinion of Claude that the other Fae did. Why'd he tell two stories? Which do you believe? Dermot shrugged.
Maybe both are true, more or less, he said. I think Claude was reluctant to leave this human world. He's amassing money that could be working for him here while he's in Fairy. He's been talking with lawyers about setting up a trust, or something like that. It would continue to earn him money even if he vanishes. That way, if he wants to return to this world, he will be a rich man and able to live as he wants. And there are advantages, even when you live in Fairy, to having financial assets here.
Like what? Dermot looked surprised.
Like having the ability to buy things that aren't available in Fairy, he said. Like having the wherewithal to make trips out here occasionally, to indulge in things that aren't acceptable in our own world.
Like what? I asked again.
Some of us like human drugs and sex, Dermot said, and some of us like human music very much. And human scientists have thought of some wonderful products that are very useful in our world.
I was tempted to say, like what, a third time, but I didn't want to sound like a parrot. The more I heard, the more curious it seemed. Why do you think Claude went with Niall? I asked instead.
I think he wants to become secure in Niall's affection,
Dermot said promptly,
and I think he wants to remind the rest of the Fey world what an enticing option they have cut off, since Niall closed the portals and guards them so rigorously. But I don't know.
He shrugged.
I'm his kinsman, so he has to shelter me and defend me, but he doesn't have to confide in me.
So he's still trying to have it both ways, I said.
Yes,
Dermot said simply.
That's Claude.
Just then there was a knock at the back door. Dermot raised his head and sniffed.
There's one of the troubles,
he said, and went to answer it. Our caller was Belenos the elf, whose needle-like inch-long teeth were terrifying when he smiled. I remember how he'd grinned when he presented me with the head of my enemy. Our new visitor had bloody hands.
What you been doing, Belenos? I asked, proud that my voice was so even.
I've been hunting, my fair one,
he said, and gave me that scary grin.
I was complaining of being restless, and Dermot gave me leave to hunt in your woods. I had a wonderful time.
What did you catch?
A deer,
he said.
A full-grown doe.
It wasn't hunting season, but I didn't think anyone from the Department of Wildlife and Fisheries was going to find Belenos. One look at his true face, and they'd run screaming.
Then I'm glad you took the opportunity, I said, but I resolved to have a private word with Dermot about granting hunting privileges on my land without consulting me.
Some of the rest of us would like to hunt here, too,
the elf suggested.
I'll think about it, I said, none too pleased at the idea.
Long as that hunting was restricted to deer and you stayed on my land, I'll let you know soon.
My kindred are getting restless,
Belenos said, in what was not quite a warning.
We would all like to get out of the club. We would all like to visit your woods, experience the peacefulness of your house.
I shoved my deep uneasiness down in a little pocket inside me. I could fish it out later and have a good look at it after Belenos left.
I understand, I said, and offered him water.
When he nodded, I poured a glassful of cold water from the pitcher in the refrigerator. He gulped it all down. Hunting deer in the dark with your bare hands was apparently thirsty work. After the water was gone, Belenos asked if he could clean up, and I pointed out the hall bathroom and put out a towel. When the door was safely shut, I gave Dermot a look.
I know you have reason to be angry, Sookie, he said.
He came closer and dropped his voice.
Belenos is the most dangerous. If he gets tense and bored, bad things will happen. It seemed wisest to give him a safety valve. I hope you'll forgive me for granting him permission, since we're family.
Dermot's big blue eyes, so like my brother's, looked at me imploringly. I wasn't too pleased, but Dermot's reasoning made all kinds of sense. The image of a repressed elf finally cutting loose on the people of Monroe was a picture I didn't want in my head.
I get what you're saying, I told him, but if you ever want to let someone run free on my land again, check with me first.
And I gave him a very level look to let him know I meant it.
I will, he said.
I wasn't convinced. Dermot was a lot of good things, but I couldn't see him as a strong or decisive leader.
They're tired of waiting, he said hopelessly. I guess I am too.
Would you leave for Fairy? I asked.
I tried a smile. Can you live without your HGTV and your Cheetos? I wanted to ask my great uncle if he could live without me, but that would be too pitiful. We'd gotten along without each other just fine for most of our lives, but there was no denying I was fond of him.
I love you,
he said unexpectedly.
The happiest I've been in years is the time I've spent here with you, in this house. It's so peaceful.
This was the second time in a few minutes that a fae had said my house was peaceful. My conscience stirred inside me. I suspected very strongly that it was not me or the house that attracted creatures with fae blood. It was the hidden presence of the Cluvial Door. Belenos came out wrapped in a towel, holding out his bloody clothes. His pallor and his freckles extended all over.
Sister, can you wash these in your machine? I had only planned to scrub my face and arms,
but I thought how good it would feel to be completely clean.
As I took the stained clothes to the washer on the back porch, I was glad I'd taken Mr. Cataliades' warning to heart. If the Cluvial Door had such influence when they couldn't even see it, didn't even know it was present, how much more would they want to touch it if they could? What would they do if I wouldn't give it up? After I'd started Balanos's clothes on the cold cycle, I remained on the back porch, looking out through the screen door at the night. The bugs were in full symphony. It was almost noisy enough to be annoying. I was glad all over again for the blessed invention of air conditioning, even if the house was cooled by window units instead of central heat and air. I could close and lock my windows at night and keep the drone of the insects at bay, and feel safe against the appearance of other things. One of those other things was strolling out of the trees right now.
"Hey, Bill," I said quietly.
"Sookie."
He moved closer. Even when I knew he was there, I couldn't hear him. Vampires can be so quiet.
"I guess you heard my visitor," I said.
"Yes. Found what was left of the deer." "Elf?"
"Balanos. You've met him."
"The guy who took the heads?" "Yeah. Dermot is home?"
"He's here."
"You really shouldn't be alone with Balanos."
Bill, a serious guy, sounded very grim indeed when he said this.
"I don't intend to be. Dermot will take him back to Monroe, either tonight or tomorrow morning. Eric call you tonight?"
"Yeah, I'm going to Shreveport in an hour. I'm meeting Heidi there."
He hesitated for a moment.
"I understand she still has a living relative."
"Her son in Nevada. He's a drug addict, I believe."
"To have living flesh of your flesh, it must be a very strange feeling to be able to talk to your immediate kin. This age of vampires is so much different from that when I was turned. I can hardly believe that I now know my great-great-great-grandchildren."
Bill's maker had ordered him out of Bontal and even out of the state for a long time, so he wouldn't be recognized by his wife and children or his local acquaintances. That was the old way. I noted the wistfulness in his voice.
"I don't think it's been very healthy for Heidi to keep in touch with her son," I said. "She's younger than he is now, and..."
Then I shut up. The rest of the sad story was Heidi's to tell.
"Several days ago, Danny Prideaux came to me to ask if he can be my daytime man,"
Bill said suddenly, and after a moment I understood that Bill was thinking of human connections.
So the hat was Danny's big secret.
"Huh, he already has a part-time job at the lumberyard."
"With two jobs, he thinks he can ask his young woman to marry him."
"Oh, wow. Danny's gonna ask Kennedy to marry him? That's wonderful. You know who he's dating? Kennedy, who works behind the bar at Merlot's."
"The one who killed her boyfriend."
Bill seemed displeased by this bit of information.
"Bill, the guy was beating her, and she served her jail time. Not that you have any room to talk. You hired him?"
Bill looked a little abashed.
"I agreed to a trial period. I don't have enough work for a full-time person, but it would be very pleasant to have a part-time helper. I wouldn't have to ask you for help all the time, which I'm sure is inconvenient for you."
"I haven't minded making the occasional phone call," I said, "but I know you'd like to have someone you don't have to keep thanking. I wish Danny'd tell Kennedy what he's up to. Not knowing is making her have all kinds of bad thoughts about him."
"If they're going to have a real relationship, she has to learn to trust him."
Bill gave me an enigmatic look and melted back into the trees.
"I trust people when they've proved they're trustworthy," I muttered, and went back in the house. The kitchen was empty. It sounded like Balanos and Dermot had gone upstairs to watch television. I caught the faint sound of a laugh track. I climbed halfway up the stairs, intending to suggest that Balanos move his own clothes from the washer to the dryer, but I paused when I heard them talking during a commercial break.
"It's called 2½ Men, Dermot was telling his guest.
"I understand," Balanos said, "because the two brothers are grown and the son isn't."
"I think so," Dermot said. "Don't you think the son is useless?"
"The half, yes. At home, we'd eat him,"
Balanos said. I turned right around, sure I could put the clothes into the dryer myself.
"Sookie, do you need us?"
Dermot called. I might have known he'd hear me.
Just tell Belenos that I'm putting his clothes in the dryer, but he's responsible for getting them out. I think they'll be drying.
I made some hasty calculations.
Probably 4 to 5 minutes. I'm going to bed now.
Though I'd had the nap, I was beginning to drag. I barely waited to hear Dermot say, "He'll get them," before I hurried to the back porch to toss the wet clothes into the dryer. Then I went into my bedroom, shut the door, and locked it. If the rest of the Fae were as casual about cannibalism as the elf, Claude couldn't come back soon enough to suit me. Chapter 7 Cara Ambroselli called me first thing Monday morning, which was not a great way to start the week. "I need you to come to the station so I can ask a few more questions," she said, and she sounded so brisk and awake that I could easily dislike her.
"I've told you everything I know," I said, trying to sound alert.
"We're going over everything again," she said. "I know you're as anxious as we all are to find out who caused this poor woman's death." There was only one possible response.
"I'll be there in a couple of hours," I said, trying not to sound sullen. "I'll have to ask my boss if I can be late to work."
That really wasn't going to be an issue since I was scheduled to work the later shift, but I was grumpy enough to drag my heels. I did call Jason to tell him where I was going, because I think someone always needs to know where you are if you're going into a police station.
"That's no good, sis," he said.
"You need a lawyer?"
"No, but I'm taking a number with me just in case," I said.
I looked at the front of the refrigerator until I spotted the Osiecki and Hilburn business card. I made sure my cell phone was charged. Just to cover all kinds of crises, I put the Cluvial Door into my purse. I drove to Shreveport without noticing the blue skies, the shimmering heat, the big mowers, the 18-wheelers. I was in a grim mood, and I wondered how career criminals managed. I was not cut out for a life of crime, I decided, though the past few years had held enough mayhem to last me until I was using a walker. I hadn't had anything to do with the death of Kim Rowe, but I'd been involved in sufficient bad stuff to make me nervous when I came under official scrutiny. Police stations are not happy places at the best of times. If you're a telepath with a guilty conscience, this unhappiness is just about doubled. The heavy woman on the bench in the waiting room was thinking about her son, who was in a cell in the building. He'd been arrested for rape. It wasn't the first time. The man ahead of me was picking up a police report about an accident he'd been in. His arm was in a sling, and he was in a fair amount of pain. Two men sat silently side by side, their elbows on their knees, their heads hung. Their sons had been arrested for beating another boy to death. It was a positive treat to see T-Rex come out of a door, apparently leaving the building. He glanced my way, kept moving, but did a double take.
"Sookie, right?"
Under the harsh light, his dyed platinum hair looked garish, but also cheerful, simply because he was such a vital person.
"Yeah,"
I said, shaking his hand.
"Pretty vamps girl from Bon Ton?"
He was having his own little stream of consciousness about me.
"They call you in, too?"
"Yeah, I'm doing my civic duty," he said with a very small smile. "Cherie and Viv already came in."
I tried to smile in a carefree way. I didn't think I was very successful.
"I guess we all gotta help them find out who killed that girl," I offered.
"We don't have to enjoy it."
I was able to give him a genuine smile.
"That's very true. Did they wring a confession out of you?"
"I can't keep secrets," he said. "That's my biggest confession. Seriously, I'd have told them anything after we were here a couple of hours the night it happened. T-Rex is not one for secrets."
T-Rex was one for talking about himself in the third person, apparently, but he was so vivid, so full of life, that to my surprise, I found I liked him.
"I have to go tell them I'm here," I said apologetically, and took a step toward the window.
"Sure," he said. "Listen, give me a call if you ever want to come to a wrestling match. I get the feeling you ain't been to many, if at all, and you might have a good time. I can get you a ringside seat."
"That's real nice of you," I said. "I don't know how much time I'll have between my job and my boyfriend, but I do appreciate the offer."
"I never hung around with vampires before. That Felipe, he's pretty damn funny, and Horst is okay."
T-Rex hesitated.
"On the other hand, your boyfriend is pretty damn scary."
"He is," I agreed, "but he didn't murder Kim Rowe."
Our conversation ended when Detective Ambroselli called me to her desk. Kara Ambroselli was a little dynamo. She asked me the same questions she'd asked me Saturday night, and I answered them the same way. She asked me a few new questions. How long have you been dating Eric? He was no longer Mr. Northman, I noticed. Did you ever work in a strip club? That was an easy one. What about the men you live with? What about them? Doesn't Claude Crane own a strip club?
Yeah,
I said wearily. He does. Did Kim Rowe ever work there? I was taken aback. I don't know, I said. I never thought about that. I guess she might have. You call Crane your cousin? Yeah, he is. We got no record of him being related to you. It would be interesting to know what records they could possibly have about Claude, since he wasn't human. He comes from an illegitimate birth, I said. It's private family business. No matter how many times she asked questions about Claude, I stuck to my guns. She eventually gave in to my determination, since there was really no way she could link Kim to Claude to me. At least, I hoped that was the case. This was something else I needed to talk to Claude about, when I had the chance. I'd nodded to Mike Coughlin, who was sitting a few desks away. He'd been doing some paperwork, but now he was talking to a young man who sat with his back to me. It was the guy who'd watched the gate to Eric's community on Saturday night. Ambroselli had been called away by another police officer, one in uniform, so I felt free to listen, and there was nothing wrong with my hearing. Evidently, Coughlin had asked, and I had a hard time remembering the name he'd had on his shirt. Vince, that was it. Coughlin had asked Vince why he'd been substituting for Dan Shelley the night of Eric's party. Dan was sick, Vince said instantly. I could tell his mind was full of agitation, and I wondered what was so scary. He asked me to sit in for him, said it was easy work. I needed the money, so I said sure. Did Dan tell you what was wrong with him? Mike Coughlin was persistent and thorough, if not brilliant. Sure, he said he'd had too much to drink. I'd keep that to myself, normally, but we're talking about murder here, and I don't want to get into trouble. Coughlin gave Vince a level stare. I'm betting it was you called us to the scene, he said. Why didn't you own up to it? We're not supposed to call the cops, Vince said. Dan said the vamp tips him big to keep his mouth shut about his doings. The vamp, that is. He's seen other girls in trouble? There was an ominous undertone to Coughlin's voice. No, Dan would have called that in. No, the extra money was just to keep Dan quiet about the goings and the comings from the house. There are reporters and just plain snoopy people who'd pay to know who visits a vampire. This vampire, Eric whatever, he didn't want his girlfriend to catch grief about staying over at his place. I hadn't known that. But when I stood up to stretch, I could see the front of his yard, and I saw the body lying there. I didn't know who it was, but she wasn't moving. That's definitely the kind of thing I need to report to the police. Vince was practically glowing with virtue by the time he finished his account. The detective was regarding Vince with open skepticism, and Vince's glow of civic virtue diminished with every second of Coughlin's stare. Yeah, buddy, Coughlin said finally. I find that real interesting, since you couldn't possibly see the girl's body from the guard shack, unless you did that big stretch while you were hovering over the ground. I tried to remember the lay of the land in the little gated community while Vince goggled at the detective. Coughlin was right. Eric's house was higher than the guard shack, and furthermore, the row of crepe myrtles by the walkway would prevent an easy sight line. I sure wanted to hold Vince's hand. It would make it so much easier to find out what was going on in his head. I sighed. There was simply no casual way to touch flesh with a virtual stranger. Kara Ambroselli returned, looking impatient. The interview staggered on for 30 more minutes. I gradually understood that Ambroselli had assembled a lot of facts about each of the people present at the scene, but that all these facts might not add up to anything. She appeared to be homing in on the stripper part of Kim Rowe's life, rather than the desperate and reckless part, or the part-where part. I had no idea how to make that add up to clues about why Kim Rowe had shown up at Eric's house, or who'd paid her to do so. But to me, it seemed obvious that the girl had been bribed to do her best to seduce Eric. Who'd paid for this and what they hoped to gain? I was as far from discovering the guilty party as Ambroselli. While I worked that night, I went over and over the events of Saturday at Eric's house. I served beers on autopilot. By the time I fell into bed, I found I couldn't remember any of the conversations I'd had with customers and co-workers. Tuesday was another black hole. Dermot came in and out without saying much. He didn't look happy. In fact, he looked anxious. When I asked him a question or two, he said, "The Fae at the club, they're worried. They wonder why Claude left, when he'll return, what will happen to them when he does. They wish they had seen Niall." "I'm sorry about Niall's attitude," I said hesitantly. I didn't know if I should broach the subject or not. It had to be a painful one for Dermot, Niall's son, to be so pushed aside and disregarded. Dermot looked at me, his eyes as pathetic as a puppy's. "What's fairy like?" I asked, in a clumsy attempt to change the subject.
"It's beautiful," he said immediately. "The forests are green, and they stretch for miles and miles, not as far as they used to, but still, they're green and deep and full of life. The shoreline is stony, no white sand beaches, but the ocean is green and clear."
He stood, lost in dreaming of his homeland. I wanted to ask a thousand questions. How did the Fae pass their time? Did creatures like Belenos mix with the fairies? Did they get married? What was childbirth like? Were they rich and poor? But when I saw the grief in my great-uncle's face, I kept my curiosity to myself. He shook himself, gave me a bleak look. Then he turned to go upstairs, probably to seek consolation in House Hunters International. That night was notable only for what didn't happen. Eric didn't call me. I understood that his out-of-town company had the biggest claim on his time, but I felt almost as shoved aside and disregarded as Dermot. As far as I was concerned, the vampires of Shreveport weren't speaking to me, consulting me, or visiting me. Even Bill was conspicuously absent. Mustafa was presumably still searching for Warren, and Broselli was presumably searching for the killer of Kim Rowe. Normally, I was a pretty cheerful person, but I wasn't seeing an end to this complicated situation, and I began to think there might never be one. I made a creditable effort to leap out of bed with enthusiasm the next morning. I was rested, and I had to go to work, no matter what was happening in the supernatural world. Not a creature was stirring, not even an elf. I ate some yogurt and granola and strawberries, drank some coffee, and put on some extra makeup since I was still feeling unhappy in general. I took a few minutes to paint my fingernails. A girl's gotta have a little color in her life. At the bustling post office, I used my key to empty the Merlot's mailbox, which served Sam for both business and personal use. Sam had gotten 3 envelopes from his duplex tenants. I riffled through the flyers that had been stuffed in the box and saw that the only bill worth worrying about was the electric bill. It soared in the summer, of course, since we had to keep the bar cool. I was almost scared to open it. I bit the bullet and slit the envelope. The total was bad, but no more than I expected. Terry Balfleur pushed open the glass door while I was tossing unwanted mail into the trash. He looked good, more alert, not as skinny maybe. There was a woman with him. When Terry stopped to speak to me, she smiled. She needed some dental work, but it was a good smile.
"Sook, this here's Jimmy Kearney from Clarice," Terry said. "She raises Catahoulas too."
Terry loved his dogs, and he seemed to have overcome his bad luck with them. His latest bitch, Annie, had her second litter of puppies. This time they'd been purebred. I'd heard Terry talk about Jimmy when he'd found a match for Annie, but I'd assumed Jimmy was a guy. She very much wasn't. "I'm pleased to meet you," I said. Jimmy was younger than Terry. I put her at about 40. There were streaks of gray in her long brown hair, which hung nearly down to her waist. She wore baggy khaki shorts with a ruffled white peasant blouse and huaraches.
"I heard a lot about you," Jimmy said shyly. "You should come by Terry's and see the puppies. My Tombo is the daddy. They're just as cute as they can be, and we've got them all sold. We had to check out the homes they would go to, of course."
"Good job," I said. I was getting the information from Jimmy's head that she was over at Terry's a lot of the time. A lot. Just in my little peek, Jimmy seemed like an okay person. Terry deserved someone really nice. He needed someone really, really stable. I hoped she was both.
Well, maybe I'll get a chance to see those puppies before they go to their new homes. I'm glad I got to meet you, Jimmy. Terry, talk to you later. Before I headed to the bar, I needed to check on Tara, who hadn't returned my calls. Maybe she'd gone to work today, too? Sure enough, her car was parked beside Tara's togs. Inside, she was sitting at the wedding table, the one where brides sat to order their invitations and their napkins and anything else a bride could want. Tara? I said, because the expression on her face was very peculiar. How come you didn't call me back? What's the faced mean? Does that mean you're going to have the baby soon? Mm-hmm, she said, but it was clear her attention was on something else entirely. Where's McKenna? Tara's assistant had been working more and more hours as Tara grew more and more great with child. Well, great with children.
She's at home. She's been run off her feet. I told her to stay home today, that I'd work. Today's my last day.
You don't look like you can work a whole 8 hours, I said cautiously. Tara had gotten pretty snappish during her pregnancy, and the bigger she got, the more likely she'd become to give you her unvarnished opinion on almost anything, but especially if you said something about her stamina or appearance.
I can't, she said,
and my mouth fell open.
How come?
I said.
I'm having the babies today.
I felt a thread of panic rise up out of my stomach.
Who all knows this, Tara? You? You haven't called anyone else? No, I'm just trying to deal, having a little moment here.
She tried to smile.
But I guess you better call McKenna and tell her to come in to work, and you better call JB and tell him to get to the hospital in Clarice, and you could call his mama. Oh, and maybe the ambulance. Oh my God, you're hurting? Oh, Shepherd of Judea.
She glared at me, but I don't think she knew she was looking at me like she hoped I'd turn green.
It's not too bad yet, she said with an air of great restraint. But my water broke just now, and since it's twins.
I was already punching in 911. I described the situation to the dispatcher, and she said,
Sookie, we'll be right over to get Tara. You tell her not to worry. Oh, and she can't eat or drink anything, you hear?
Yes, I said.
I hung up.
Tara, they're coming. Nothing to eat or drink. You see any food around here? She said. Not a damn thing. I've been trying to keep my weight gain to a minimum, so Mr. Bare Naked Booty will have something to keep him home when I get over having his children.
He loves you, and I'm calling him right now. Which I did. After a frozen moment, JB said,
I'm coming. Wait, if you called the ambulance, I'll meet it at the hospital. Have you called the doctor?
She didn't put him on my list. I was waving my hands in agitation. I'd made a mistake.
I'll do it, JB said, and I hung up.
Since there didn't seem to be anything I could do to help Tara, she was sitting absolutely still with an expression of great concentration on her face, I called Mrs. Durone, who said very calmly,
All right, if you're going to stay there with Tara, I'll drive straight to the hospital. Thank you, Sookie.
Then, without hanging up, she shrieked,
Donald, go start the car. It's time.
I hung up. I called McKenna, who said,
Oh my God, I just got out of bed.